This series, So You Want to Be a Board Member, consists of 8 one-hour sessions designed for those new to nonprofit board service. Even if you are an experienced board member, with the ongoing changes to the sector, you will walk away with valuable information. Here's Session 5. Ensure the Availability of Sufficient Resources, Part 2. This session is the second part of 2 sessions on funding. Whether or not you will personally be responsible for fundraising, you will be responsible for ensuring the organization has sufficient funds, not only to maintain its functioning, but to realize its vision. What should you consider when presented with fundraising opportunities? What are the questions you must ask? Should you expect to give a monetary gift along with your time? This session answers these questions. Consultants Karen Eber-Davis and Laura McCuska lead the session.
I'm going to quickly do a review of last session with a quick overview of the 7 sources of nonprofit income that Karen had gone over last week. We specifically focused on a couple of them last week, but I'll just quickly go over this. The first one is mission income, and that's the funding you receive from a customer who pays it to receive mission-related service or product. For example, the income from ticket sales for your theater. The next one is dedicated individuals. So this would be individual giving from various types of sources, be it from throwing something in a jar at the grocery store to all the way to planning a bequest in your... The next income source is the government. Government does fund a lot of nonprofit organizations, and some of them are even predominantly government funded. This could include grants or contracts and earmarks. Income source number 4 is nonprofit venture capital foundations and other organizations. So approximately 125,000 foundations exist in the United States and Canada, and they provide grants with specific goals to nonprofit organizations. Income source number 5 would be corporations. These would be corporate and business contributions, and we'll talk a bit more in depth about those later. Income source number 6 is unrelated income. These are things that have not necessarily related to your organization's mission, but they provide income to your organization. And the last one would be in-kind donations to your organization, those that don't involve a direct handover of or exchange of money and tax receipt. So those are the 7 sources, and now Karen is going to talk about earned revenue.
Thank you, Laura. I want to start too by saying we'll be talking about all these sources a little bit more in depth, but still, this is still just scratching the surface. But as a board member, if you learn about these, you're way ahead of many of your co-board members, and it allows you to understand that there are many tools for income. So I'm going to start today talking about earned revenue. I'm going to share a quick story of an example of it, another example, and then I'll be sharing some benefits and some risks associated with it, and then the last piece of each part of this segment of each income discussion that I'll be sharing today will be some questions as a board member that you might want to ask as you're sitting at a meeting or learning about the nonprofit. So we're going to start with a story about a woman named Janet. She runs a nonprofit that is heavily government-funded, and it provides services for child care providers throughout the community she serves. These providers were coming to her and saying they had a large problem and very concerned because it impacted the quality of the child care being provided. And that was when their providers and teachers were sick, they could not find good substitutes. And what ended up happening is that they often had to leave their role as the executive director of a small child care provider and go serve as a teacher in the classroom, which meant nothing else got done in terms of oversight of the organization that day. And then when there were 2 staff members absent, they had trouble with keeping their state mandated ratios, etc. So what she did in working with her, the project I worked on, is I helped her to develop an earned revenue opportunity that provided the service that they needed. We went and checked with the daycare providers and said, are you really serious about this? Would you put money into it? And the answer we got was yes. And so we helped them to create a substitute pool for the teachers. And so we found people interested in doing that on a part-time basis, and we made sure they were trained, and we made sure they had all their health certificates and those kinds of things correct. And then with the buying power of many, many nonprofits, we were able to keep a pool of people going. So this is an earned mission opportunity that basically broke even, but it created more mission in the community. And that's what this type of income does. You earn mission, you obtain mission, and you also earn some revenue for it. So the benefits are clear. Besides just money, you have a lot of versatility with this. So you could solve a problem like Janet did by providing a new service that you get paid for, or many other ways. You also have a lot of control with it as a nonprofit. If you decide that you really want to have to change the fees on how that pool works, of what you have to pay to be in the pool, you have that flexibility without having to go back to a funder, a donor, or a government to get to work with them. And then also it tends to enhance your brands. Those daycare providers were really happy that Janet could provide that service because that served a real need for them, and it helped everyone out. So that really enhanced what her role was in the community. Now, with all nonprofit income and all income in general, there are some risks. And some of those, again, there's more than listed today, but there's a few to think about, is sometimes there's a philosophical conflict. Many nonprofit people feel that they want to receive only donated money and that money is pure and best for their cause and that their cause is worthy about that. So you may run into people saying, no, we can't charge fees and it's against our policies or our beliefs. So that's a possible challenge. Another one is your staff may not have the skills. They may have been receiving and have skills in other areas and have not really been comfortable in the whole process of earning money. And that, as a consultant, you can understand where you could help them. There's some skills there that you bring to the table as a board member in this area. Practicalities, of course, any business venture could fail, and you have upfront costs, which Janet did. And she was able to meet those by doing some budget switching, but she had sought a grant, and that was not successful, but she was able to find other budget money to do it, but there were upfront costs, and that is always a possibility. We could have run into that the daycare providers weren't that interested. You know, they were complaining, but they really didn't want to put money into it, but that was not the case. So the mission this is something that needs to be planned and thought about as an income source, but it's certainly a very good one for many people, and many nonprofits make money at it. So as a board member, here are some things that if you were hearing about an opportunity or even wanting to know why we haven't pursued more of these as a nonprofit, you might be asking. And the first question is basically an orientation question, and that is, what is your organization's current relationship with mission earned income? Are you earning any? And how does it work? What sources are there? And then another important question is, what does the funding flow look like? Many people across, not even just nonprofits, will say, oh, well, we're covering our expenses, but they haven't necessarily looked at all the expenses that are being impacted by a nonprofit. So classically, if we have a basketball clinic, I'm saying, yes, you know, I've got enough money to pay my instructors and to do the marketing, but perhaps I haven't considered that I have some executive director time involvement in that, as well as audit fees, et cetera, turning the lights on. So helping them to say how much of this fee that we're charging, what's still left over, and then planning for that gap if there is any. And then to learn what the strengths are that the nonprofit has around this area and how to grow them. And then if they're blocked in this, what's keeping them from moving forward? Because, again, this is the largest source of nonprofit income. And, again, I believe most nonprofits can tap this. So look at those barriers. So, again, this is mission-earned income is the largest source. Again, this is just an introduction of some of the risks and benefits and some of the questions that you might want to ask if you're sitting at a nonprofit board meeting. And the next week, talk to Laura, where you're backed up. Talk about individual donations.
Thanks, Karen.
Yes, last time we talked about the many varied ways individuals give to nonprofits, and I'll just give you a quick overview. There's special events, and that would be sort through ticket sales, auctions, registration fees for tournaments or a-thons. Kathy Kingston last time led us through the world of galas and benefit auctions. There's also membership fees. As I mentioned, change in the jar at the grocery store. Donations, everything from the annual appeal to monthly giving and major gifts. And ultimately, planned gifts. Bequests and your will are the most common form of planned gifts. Today we're going to look at how, using well-tested and successful techniques, you can create the right conditions to offer a major gift. You might ask, what's a major gift? It varies from nonprofit to nonprofit. A small animal shelter may rejoice at a gift of $1,000, while a large hospital foundation may set the bar considerably higher at $25,000, $50,000, or even $100,000. Whatever the level, the goal is to first determine three things about your prospect through research. The first is linkage. What is the prospect's relationship to the organization? For example, are they a former board member, a friend of the organization, an alum, a current donor? Do they have some sort of professional affiliation with you? The next is to determine their ability. Does your research show that they've given to other nonprofits at significant donation levels? Have you read about their company in the business pages? What other donation have they given, and what does their history show? And the final one is their interest. Have they demonstrated an interest in your organization, in one of your programs, in a similar organization? If they show little or no interest or have no knowledge about you, your chances of getting a gift are very small. So we call this the LAI, linkage, ability, and interest. So if you've done your homework and can show that the prospect does indeed have strong linkage, has the ability to give you a significant gift, and appears to be passionate about your mission, vision, and values, you're set to begin cultivation in earnest. Cultivation is the process of engaging and maintaining the interest and involvement of a prospect or donor in your people, program, and plans. It can be through ongoing communication through some things like newsletters, email, and your website, but it can also be face-to-face meetings with board members and senior executive, whether at formal events or informal lunches. Actually, any contact engages them in your mission can be part of your cultivation program. You want to solicit their input on what you're doing. Make them feel welcome and a part of your organization. Cultivation takes place over time, so you can't expect to identify a prospect and quickly ask for a major gift. You'll know when to ask when all the rights fall into place. So what are these rights? What are the rights? The best solution occurs when the right prospect is asked for the right gift by the right person at the right time in the right way. So your chances of success are greater if all these line up before you make your ask. One example is a local university college here in Winnipeg that had an alum that had given some donations over the years. Although along the way he became disgruntled with the senior leadership and the development office, so he stopped giving. He had been giving away millions of dollars to other institutions during this time. So about 5 years ago, the newly hired director of development set out to bring the donor back into the fold and make him feel appreciated. He was so successful in his mission that the donor not only came back to the institution, but agreed to chair their capital campaign. He also started with what was their largest gift and actually increased it at the end of the campaign because the donor was so impressed with its success. And they named their new building after him in appreciation. So that's an example of when the rights are lining up. You might ask how this affects you as a board member. Well, normally you'd be asked to identify people that you may know that can be approached for a major gift. You may be asked to participate in the cultivation and even in the solicitation process, as well as maintaining the connection with the donor, especially if you're the one that brought the donor's name to the attention of the people in the organization. Because board members represent the leadership of the organization, major donors appreciate having a relationship with you. It makes them feel special. So what are the pluses about major gifts? Well, if they're done right, you can make friends for life. Karen pointed out that of all donations received by nonprofits, over 75% is given by individuals. That represents a significant amount of income over time. Minuses. Building and maintaining relationships take a lot of time and effort. Stewardship of donors is where many nonprofits fail and end up losing their donor base. So now Karen's going to talk to you about the next in source, government funding.
Thank you, Laura. Hope everyone's thinking, boy, there's a lot of opportunity out there, because there sure is. It's not always easy, but it's worthwhile pursuing. And this is a very large source of money, this government funding. And for my example, I picked out a source of funding that has provided local arts organizations in Sarasota about $1 million a year since 1988. And this is money that is government tax money if you come and stay at our lovely beaches, and I encourage you to do so. You will be charged as part of your fee at staying at a hotel or a condo is some bed tax money, and half of this money goes to develop tourism and goes to the Arts Alliance group in town. And once a year, they offer a grant program for arts and cultural groups that they can apply to, and again, about 25 organizations from the ballet to small museums to all kinds of groups here receive about $1 million a year. And these funds are used for their marketing budget. The goal is to bring in people from outside the area. But certainly anytime they can do marketing, they also include, like in the local papers, which encourages local participation in the arts experiences in this area. So again, a very ongoing, since 1988, source of money. Unlikely, it has been reduced in the last couple of years because of the recession, but it still is a very solid source of funding for these arts organizations. And that's one of the key benefits of government money, is that it's often significant money. While you may receive a $1 million bequest from someone who dearly loves your organization, many times individual donations and mission-earned revenue come in much smaller denominations. So people are very attracted to this money because, again, it could be very significant funding. Mostly it starts at $20,000 and works its way up. The government funds are also really helpful for nonprofits who serve people that are basically or challenging to get donors for. For instance, young men who have continuing drug addiction problems, adults who have developmental disabilities, who need lifelong care and housing and things like that. So there's a tendency to have funds that are ongoing and significant to serve these kinds of groups. And if that's the kind of nonprofit you're working with, you may feel that this is a must to receive this funding if it's available. And then another key thing is often the barriers are high to get in. The first application can be very difficult, or can be very difficult to get the contract. But once you are in, there's a tendency, even in this climate, to be able to get renewal funds. What are the risks? Well, as you've heard medical offices complain, usually the government will not pay for everything or all the costs associated with providing the service. And they certainly will not pay for your preparing the application or the process of getting that money before you actually are awarded it. So all that is risk that you face because you have to put together an application or stand in line to get these funds and perform certain tasks in order to receive them, and all that will not be in reimbursed. It's also high risk. Winners will take all. You may do a wonderful application and miss it by one point. It's also been heard that, yes, we plan to give this money, but something happens and the money is not given out, so people have applied and officially been awarded the money but not received it. So it's a high-risk game in that sense. And the other important risk to be aware of is that often government funds have unintended impacts. If you receive government funding long-term, you will begin to need to have staff to monitor that, and it becomes fairly responsive and needs to be responsive to bureaucracy, which may not be as donor-developed or whatever. And there's a tendency, same sort of area, is people get hooked into this fund. Many groups have way too much government funding and not enough other income, which is part of why we're doing this teleconference, is because there are other options and they need to be thinking about how to move out of heavy government funding dependency, especially in this climate. So as the board, one of the questions you would want to ask if you're approaching new government funding is, does this government funding make sense for us? Is this a good fit with our mission and where we want to go? And also part of that is, if you're looking at a new opportunity, is those should be vetted very carefully. You will find, as with foundations, which I'll talk about in a minute, that you qualify for a large number of programs, However, the odds of you receiving them are actually probably pretty low. And so when I'm looking at a federal opportunity, if I don't see that it's going to be available for 200 or 300 nonprofits, I'm not real interested in it, because many times there's great programs, but they're only going to be offered in 5 places. And working in Southwest Florida is just not a compelling community compared to New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago, the bigger communities that tend to get some of this initial funding from government agencies. And the last piece, which is sort of opposite what I've just said about being careful about entering this field and making sure you want to make the investment, is if you do think, see a fund and believe it really, really fits your mission, you should persevere, even if you're not successful the first time, because there's a lot of success that happens because of what you've learned by applying one time. You have a chance to get an application draft together. You have a chance to learn where you weren't strong and where other people were strong so you can fix it. And you have a chance to think about it often for a year and improve your odds of receiving that fund. So that's the third source of funding. We've talked about mission-earned income, and Laura talked about individual giving. That was government. And now at this point, we're shrinking, going to sources that are much smaller for the next 2 or 3. The last one is big again. And this is foundations and other organization funding. My example for this comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who recently granted the Northwest Colorado Visiting Nurse Association $500,000. And the goal of this funding, and this funding is to help them do, is promote optimal physical, mental, and social well-being and function for isolated seniors in rural Colorado. And I'm going to make a note right away. This is an exceptionally large grant. Most foundation funds are not in this range. So I thought this was attractive in terms of showing that it provides something that probably doesn't exist at this point. It's a futuristic, something that's going to happen. And foundations tend to love things that are new and can be expanded and repeated. So probably Robert Wood Johnson is very interested in giving this money to see if in the future this is a model that can be used elsewhere. So they're often very creative as part of that. The benefit, besides the money, is that getting funds from the Robert Wood Johnson, which funds a lot of healthcare groups, would be very prestigious and encourage other donations as well as your standing in the community. I have one client who recently had a chance to get a Ford Foundation grant piece of it. And they really, really wanted the money for the prestige. It was mission drift for them. They didn't want the money for the project, but they really had a hard time saying no, which is what they eventually did, because it was so much prestige in getting that funding and being able to list it on their marketing material. The other benefit of this fund is nonprofits and foundations often have very similar thinking in terms of both wanting to improve the community, are both kind of in line with how can we do this better, how can we improve. And so you have an understanding, and a foundation may understand very well what you're trying to do and be willing to work with you on that and think about it with you. Another key benefit, I've seen this very much in the field as I've worked in it for over 17 years, is that there's an emphasis on excellence. The applications and materials that I saw 17 years ago were very sketchy, say it that way. And what we see now is a growing professionalism, even at application level as well as on projects. So there's a push, because it's competitive, to do really excellent work. And that has a lot of attraction for nonprofits who want to be recognized and want to grow and want to improve. And I would think as a nonprofit, a consultant, you would be interested in working with groups who have that desire. The other piece on this is there's benefits, but there's also risk. Again, it's a cost thing. A foundation and other funds will generally not pay for all the costs associated either with the preparation of the application or even the entire program. Almost all foundations and other requests are saying, who else is putting money into this pot? We do not want to be in the loan, and we do not want to be a forever funder for you. So we're looking as a foundation and other organization to come in and perhaps just fund you this one time and then fund somebody else in the future. Another challenge is it's basically a needle in the haystack situation. Laura talked about how many foundations and other groups are out there who fund this way. of the 125,000 in the U.S. and Canada, probably you're going to find that you might really, really qualify and really have a shot with maybe 100. And most groups, unless they're very large, can work with 25 to 50. Finally, the next biggest thing for me about the challenges of funding is nonprofits want and need operating funds. The challenge is that these funds generally are not operating funds, and so we have a lot of let's dress up this operating fund to look like a grant project. And so you sometimes find people seeking these foundation funds, but it's not going to give them what they really need for stability, which is ongoing operating funds. So as a board member, what do you need to know? The first key thing to being successful with foundations and other funding is about that you create an excellent organization, because that's what's competitive. Many of these applications ask a lot of details about your organization, i.e., how many board members attend meetings, how often they give, how have they been solicited, what is the gift range, those kinds of questions. And it goes beyond that, but that's the board piece. The other piece that's very helpful for a board member to come in is to help the other board members and the staff set realistic expectations. You need to understand how grant works. That's always a competitive process, or nearly always. Relationship helps, and it's not likely to solve all your funding challenges. What grants work best for, in my opinion, is they are the puzzle piece that makes the arch go. If you're building an arch, you've seen that with blocks that build an arch, and there's a core arch piece at the top. That's what a grant will do. It's the last piece that makes the whole thing work. That's a very good model for what a grant will do. So if you're trying to solve a problem, how can a small piece of money make a significant difference? That's a grant fundable project. And the last thing I want to suggest is to form, as you can, personal relationships with funders. And I'm going to say that very carefully, because sometimes doing any kind of lobbying is an automatic out to boards and groups involved. But relationships are very critical. You have a much better chance of receiving these funds if you have relationships. So again, you may be asked as a board member to help as appropriate, sensitively, to create relationships with foundations and other people who give grants. And next we have Laura, and she's going to talk about corporate funding.
Thanks, Karen. You told us last time that corporate contributions are really a small piece of the nonprofit funding pie. But I'll remind everybody that 1 to 2% of the $1.5 trillion nonprofit sector in the United States and $1.5 billion in Canada is a significant sum. So individuals are by and large motivated by philanthropy, that is, the desire to promote the welfare of others, expressed especially by the generous donation of money to good causes. Corporations may also be motivated by being seen to do good in the community, and they may give large donations as well. We've all seen donor walls listing businesses that have contributed to capital campaigns. I'm sure you have examples in your own communities. However, corporations are more likely to be motivated by their bottom line. That's hardly surprising. Witness the naming of sports arenas and community places, for example, Air Canada Centre in Toronto, American Airlines Centre in Miami, and Staples Centre in Los Angeles. Think about your own location. You're bound to find examples of corporately named spaces around your community. Corporations, they also see value in partnering with nonprofits in other ways. For example, Del Monte has partnered with the Canadian Soccer Association for the next 2 years, and what they're going to do is provide product to the Canadian national teams, and also get their product in the hands of 850,000 players across the country. That's quite a few fruit cups, in my view. And in return, the CSA, the Canadian Soccer Association, will also have its logo placed on over 10 million Del Monte products. I'd say that was a win-win situation, so that Del Monte can promote their products to and be associated with a healthy brand and a really good an up-and-coming brand such as soccer. So corporations are finally understanding that they can work with nonprofits to add sponsorship to their marketing toolkit, and that helps them meet their business objective. Nonprofits are also beginning to understand that by developing relationships with corporations and understanding their goals and objectives, they can help sponsors and gain revenue. So the examples I gave earlier are really large-scale sponsorships. But your nonprofit may be dealing with much smaller scale sponsorships, such as golf tournament or other event sponsors. The principle is, however, the same. It's not what you need, it's how you can help the potential sponsor's objectives. So their objectives may be sales, they may be promotion of their brand, or it might be something like employee retention, where they want the employees to see that they're involved in doing good in the community, and that by doing a sponsorship, they can show their employees that. In all of this, having a discovery session with the potential sponsor is key. Going out with a package to say, okay, I'm going to, you know, offer something at the gold, silver, and bronze level, you might get some short-term and smaller sponsorships that way. But if you want to really work on developing the relationship, go to a discovery session and say, here's what we have as inventory. What in here could help you in your business objectives? But one small example of a successful sponsorship is a local organization's annual golf tournament. They asked the printing company to provide in-kind printing of their sponsorship brochure. They agreed to do so, and they also were happy to have their logo printed on the brochure. So when they asked them the second year in a row to do it, they immediately agreed and were able to say that some sales were generated directly as a result of having their logo on that brochure. So they were very happy with the fact that people were aware that they sponsored this, and also it raised the awareness of their company in the business community. So they were able to meet their business objectives. So what are some pluses in corporate giving? Well, engaging the corporate community through sponsorship can generate significant revenue. If you tap even into 10% of what's available in your community, you're already doing something that other nonprofits aren't doing. Some minuses are really, the big minus is fulfillment of the terms of the sponsorship agreement. It's very time consuming and you have to pay attention to it very, very closely. Failure to fulfill the terms of the contract by either the sponsor or the nonprofit, I've seen instances where it's resulted in both parties ending up in court, and you don't really want to do that. So what does it mean for you as a board member? You, again, may be asked to identify and approach corporations to discuss sponsorship. The nonprofit will benefit from your connections in the community, and that will be the most valuable thing you can contribute to corporate revenue. Karen will now take us through a look at other sources of nonprofit income.
Thank you, Laura. We're going down from the biggies down to one of the little, although this one's not so little, other income or unrelated income is actually 10% of all nonprofit income. But for many groups, it's very small and incidental. It is the interest you earn on your checking account or your savings account. It may not be very much at all. But in other cases, obviously, since it's 10% of all nonprofit income, it's a lot of fruitcake, so it's very significant. My example here is the Ruth Eckerd Hall Foundation, and this is a foundation that supports the Ruth Eckerd Performing Arts Hall in Clearwater, Florida. Each year, or in a recent year, I'm sure it's different every day, they earned $43,970 in interest income that they provided to the Performing Arts Hall. So this is income that you receive that really has nothing to do with mission. This is income. They have money in an endowment. They invest it. This income comes to the hall and is used as needed. Although the source of this money was originally individuals, now at this point, this kind of money is just other income. And this is significant. Again, many groups earn it through room rental and staff sharing, as well as where their money is kept in the market. The benefits are real clear besides the income. Usually, they're very simple in their strategy. This is about making money. So I will move my money to where I can make the best return at the risk level I'm interested in encouraging and having. And so it makes it also likely that you'll receive a similar amount in the future. If you're very good at providing a wedding venue and that gets out and you continue to market it, it's likely you'll receive a similar amount for weddings in the future. It also includes for a nonprofit, which is probably a huge relief at many levels, is minimal ongoing obligations. It's unlikely you're going to try to form a relationship with someone whom you're earning interest from or that's coming in from an out-of-town wedding. There may be some opportunities there, but usually you're providing the service, they're providing you the fee, and that's the end of it. Another benefit of this kind of income is that it's really based on familiar territory. Many board members know how to run a business, and so asking the questions and helping the staff be comfortable with this is familiar territory, and you should be, you know, it should be relatively easy, quote unquote. What are the risks? Well, many nonprofits are concerned about this risk. I don't think it's a big concern, but it will come up, is IRS complications in the United States, and I'm sure similar problems or concerns are raised in Canada about their status. People are afraid if they earn too much other income that the IRS will come and revoke their 501c3 status. In reality, in 2011, the IRS revoked for all nonprofits, 1.5 million nonprofits, for all reasons, there was about 50 revocations. So your odds are about 50 to 1.5 million, or it's like 0.00003%. So very small likelihood of that, but that's probably a concern that will be raised. The other concern is probably real, is much bigger. If you earn a lot of this funds in the community, and people feel if you're competing with them, if there's another wedding venue, they're not going to be a good donor for you, and there may be feelings that you are earning money and that you don't need their donations or any donations. So this will require some sensitivity to the community of who's out there, who you're competing with, and then if you have donors who are saying, gee, you don't need my money, some education. And finally, a risk of anything that's really not in the main focus of a nonprofit is that it can become a stepchild, and that we could have challenges with this funding that no one really looks at, and we miss thinking about it often enough to take care of it properly. So as a board member, basically your overall goal is to maximize the income and maximize the mission and figure out what the proper balance is. So a good question for this source of money is, besides what are you earning in it, is this a place that we can earn more, you know, are we earning a reasonable amount for the return that we're investing? So if you're earning a rent space for weddings and you earn $200,000 per year and you're spending about $50,000 in resources, that's going to look pretty good. But if you're spending that much money and only clearing $10,000, you probably need to relook if that's a really a viable source of income. Perhaps it's about your skill level or your pricing or some other area that needs reevaluation. This should be funding that comes to you relatively easy, that you can count on, and that can be earned in a comfortable way and not be stressful. There's enough difficulty of raising funds other ways. And so that's the goal, is to be aware that this is a significant source of income. And although it's often not thought intentionally, it's often worth considering. And you may look at what you have and realize you have assets that could be turned into more income opportunities. That's the sixth source. Now we're returning to another big boy, and that's the in-kind source. And I think it's very helpful for nonprofits to look at this as a source of income, because then it will be treated as something that gets the respect it deserves. My example in this case is a community found pharmacy that's in Florence, Kentucky. It's outside of Cincinnati. They provide pharmaceuticals to people who need them at low or no cost. They have a budget, a yearly budget of $3.2 million, and of that, $2.9 million is in-kind donations, including volunteers and the pharmaceutical products. So obvious benefit is that it brings in items, both volunteers and items that you need that will save you cash. And often, too, I would include in this area things that provide you large discounts. So someone who comes and says, I can provide that for you, and I'm only going to charge you my cost, that would be partially in this category. Another benefit of it is that it's a great entry point for new donors. A new donor may often be willing to give you stuff. It's obvious if I give you cans of food, you're probably not using them for purposes besides what the mission is. If I give you a pair of children's shoes, I don't expect you to wear them. I expect them to go to the children who need them. So there's that kind of direct connection between I'm a new donor, I can do this, I'm interested in you, I trust this interaction. And that also is partially part of that benefit of entry point is it is an interaction. The goodwill will say thank you for your donations, and it's an opportunity to build relationships and have a conversation, provide you a brochure about what we do to offer you some more interaction with our nonprofit. And the last piece of why it's really helpful to be looking at in-kind is often you can obtain unbuyable merchandise. You may be able to receive expertise, i.e., you as a consultant may not be interested in as a nonprofit as a customer, but yet you bring your expertise that you have obtained and used elsewhere in the community. Unbuyable, but very, very valuable. What are the risks? Well, you might not get what you need, or in the quantity or the quality. Some food programs find that they have to have a very big dumpster. If they're not careful about what's coming into the organization, it becomes the dumping ground, and then the food goes directly from the donation to the dumpster and does not serve anyone. Another classic example of this is when there's been earth crises like earthquakes or the like, floods, and in southern climates, and winter coats are shipped down to help people out. It's not very useful, and you can become, again, a dumping ground. It also runs the risk of confusing donors without education. I donated food. Why should I donate money? I've taken care of this. So you could be crossed off a list because you're receiving in kind if you're not also working with that, with some other enhancements that help the donors to understand that there is more need and that you are grateful, but this is not the end of the opportunity. Also, the last risk I want to share on this one is that you'd be spending a lot of resources with very little return. You may find that you're picking up, offering that the Kidney Foundation offers to pick up items, they come and there's really not very much there, but yet you've had this truck go to the neighborhood and you've invested gas. So making sure that these are good investments when you are seeking this kind of materials in kind or volunteers, that you're getting what you need. As a board member, what do you need to know? Basically, in this area, it's really a lot of more about oversight than management. You may be able to help your nonprofits to identify opportunities. Where could they find some things? They pay less than full price. Is there some discounts available? Could they get things donated? Protecting the nonprofit from being a dumping ground. This is having a policy about what the kinds of gifts you will receive and having someone who can say, thank you so much for thinking of this, but this really doesn't help us. Let me suggest what you should do with that. But having that as a way to help the nonprofit have a good barrier between undesirable and desirable items, as well as following and developing, making sure your nonprofit has proper procedures. There's tax rules. People are receiving tax benefits for making donations. You want to make sure you stay on the right side of those, so check with your accountant. And finally, I would say is that even when it's free, there are costs, and to recognize that if someone comes in and volunteers, they need to be recognized and thanked. As if someone provides you or the community provides you hundreds and thousands of pounds of food, they need to be thanked in some way. So it's not just free stuff with no obligation. The obligations are part of the in-kind experience. So that's about in-kind experience, and you've kind of been on this really fast trip. It's like a European trip you do in 7 days that shows you 7 countries in 7 days and 7 income sources for nonprofits. As a board member, our goal here is to give you an initial understanding. You would want to be diversified in what you get for funds, so be looking for more than one of these funding sources. 2 or 3 are ideal, if not more. Start with the ones that are working for your nonprofit. Study those, get better at them, and make a plan to have the income that you need. Terry, you are up, and I think you have some questions.
We do have some questions, and here again I'll invite others who had some questions pop up as we were going along and forgot where to send them, or as you hear some of the questions now and you have something you would like to add, please send them to me at terrytemkin@corestrategiesfornonprofits.com. And let me just jump in right away, and I think I'm going to turn it back. Karen, you were just talking about some of the undesirable gifts that oftentimes come in, and there was a question here about what happens if a tobacco company wants to give a major gift to a hospital. You know, you were talking about some of the in-kind gifts and some of the problems, but, you know, maybe you can talk about some of the philosophical points here, as well as perhaps the value of giving policies, et cetera.
Thank you, Terry. It's a really good question, and I think the big challenge for most nonprofits is they run into things when the money is at the door or there's someone who wants to give them something at the door. And the goal would be to avoid that and to think through as a policy, as a group, and make a gift policy and understand what it is that you will receive and to ask questions like, would we take money from someone who basically is involved in gambling if we're children, the organization? Are there money that we would not take under any circumstances? It's also important to say if someone offers us land and, you know, everyone's excited, oh boy, and then we find out that it has some environmental issues, to have some protection. There's a lot of experience, there's a lot of gift policies on the internet to start with, but having that discussion with your board members will help build your team and also protect your organization. And when you do have a great windfall, know whether it's a great one or one to say, thank you so much, but it's really, you know, our policy, we can go back to that, says that we don't accept this and direct them some other way. So having that policy gives you that buffer. It's like having a parent to pull in when you need one, when you're a little child, and, you know, my mom won't let me do that. That kind of helps you.
Great. Laura, I'm going to ask you, you were talking about sponsorships, and today that's such a big thing. A couple questions. Number one, if you're going after sponsorships, that and major gifts sounds very much like sales. And the question is, can we hire someone to work for a percentage of what they raise? I mean, clearly in business, this is what we do. We hire our salespeople with a commission. And can we do that here? It certainly is the most effective way. We don't have to pay out money on something that we may not get anything back.
That's a great question, Terry. In terms of sponsorships, sponsorship is it is sales, and technically you could ask people to work for a commission. However, it's also very much about relationships, and I would discourage people from necessarily going the commission route. You want to develop a relationship with the donor or the sponsor, so it's hard to do that when someone is asking, well, what's in it for you? You're asking me for this, and what's in it for you? And with respect to donations, someone asking for a gift is breaching the ethical policies of the ethical standards of the Association of Fundraising Professionals if they're doing it on a commission basis. So someone who's asking for a philanthropic gift should never be working on commission. The simple reason is that the donor will, if the donor doesn't know about that, and they find out later that they were working on commission, then they feel like they've been had, because this person was trying to get the most out of them that they could for their own gain, because the more they get out of the donor, the more commission they're going to make. So, you know, we always say, no, we're not working on commission, we're working on a salary, and, you know, we're working for the organization, we're getting funds for the organization. So in that way, the donors can be assured that the organization is taking care of their money, and it's not giving it to someone whose intentions are not purely philanthropic.
All right, and I said there were a couple of questions. This is related to the sponsorship area, and I'll throw it out. Either of you can probably answer it, but you were talking sponsorship. Now, there's also advertising, and there is certainly a difference. With advertising, the organization has to pay unrelated business income tax, a sponsorship, they do not. What's the difference when you are promoting either or to a business that you want to come and support you in one of these manners? What do you tell them? What do you encourage them to do? Is it sponsorship? Is it advertising?
Well, to me, those are two very different things, because advertising is a very static medium. So you might ask them to advertise in your newsletter, and that's fine. You can tell them they're going to reach X number of people, and here's your target market, and they may be quite happy with that. Sponsorship tends to be more of a partnership, where you're helping them achieve their business objectives through some creative use of the inventory that you have as a nonprofit. In terms of taxes in Canada, those two things are seen as the same. They would be business promotion in spending, so we don't differentiate here in Canada.
Okay. Karen, since I know we do differentiate here in the States, do you want to add anything? Or
I want to do a plug for something that I think is really helpful in this area. I have a podcast on my website, which is www.kedconsult.com, with two tax managers. And what I loved about that is after talking to them for 20 minutes, if there's tax concerns, you need to talk to your accountant. They have to look things up, and they had like 15 years of experience each. So as soon as someone says, oh, is this taxable or not, I just sort of want to go, nope, talk to your accountant, you know, because, again, it's each individual situation. You know, you need to look at that way.
Good. I think that's valuable advice. Let's see. Karen, you mentioned one risk associated with earned income is that an organization might say, well, we've never done this, so we can't really do this today. And clearly we're in a situation, everybody's talking about the new normal, and if the last week hasn't shown us anything, it's that there's truly, truly the new normal if there is no normal. So maybe these organizations have to start doing this. How can boards begin to really think differently? Is there a way, any hints we can suggest or anything that could be suggested to get people who say, well, we've never done this, to perhaps at least look at this?
Those are almost two different questions. I think there's a lot of opportunities that boards need to look at, and there's ways to begin to pick, you know, expand your brain and think about it, and how can we look at this in new ways, the whole kind of brainstorming creative process. The hardest thing, I think, for an earned revenue is getting the staff to be comfortable with it. And you wouldn't think that, but that's reality. Many times there's been the way we've done it before. Other staff have come because they're saying, hey, I don't want to deal with that money thing. I came because I want to do good, and I don't like the money thing. It makes me uncomfortable for whatever reason. I think one of the critical things is to find a way to explain to your staff that if we have to choose between never serving anybody again or charging some money for people, that may be our choice. And help them see that this is about, in many cases, survival. And that if we go out, no one will ever be served in this area. You know, if say we're serving the deaf or a group like that, and if we're no longer, if we provide no services, no one gets served. But if we can find a way to charge some people money and you know, be fair and equitable about it, we can continue to serve and can continue to find new ways to reach people in new ways. So it's a survival thing. Is way of finding some way that if we can open this door, we can survive and find new ideas and perhaps go back to the old way. Maybe we can find some donors who will endow us to do this. But until, if we don't survive, we can't do it at all.
So related to that, another question that came in is, what about nonprofits that never charged a fee? Is earned mission income a possibility for them? Clearly related to the question you just answered, do you want to expand on that at all?
Sure. I think it always is, and I think it must be Let me give you an example. There is a group in town who, by their charter, they're one of a multiple nonprofits that are chartered around the country. They are chartered that they cannot charge the people they serve any fees. I have sat with them, and we're still in the brainstorming session with this, and I said, okay, fine, we don't charge that group of customers fees, but how about these other service providers who would perhaps be interested in having some marketing data from the people who we are serving? Would that be something we can look at? Clearly, this is a medical concern. They're very specialized, so they very much know who the providers are in town, and they have experiences, and those providers, I believe it's a marketable product, could be learning how to improve their services better by working with the nonprofit as a conduit. So I would look to go to those service providers as possible an income flow for a nonprofit, which is my point is sometimes it's not the same market. It might be another market you never served. It might be a nonprofit who you could provide. Maybe you have an evaluation tool that you can take, and it could be used by them, and it will save them a staff person. So there's many ways to look at it. And perhaps you don't want to try to serve or even be able to serve current customers and ask them to pay for anything, but there's other people who are in your sphere of influence who you might be able to offer mission to and help and get income from.
Excellent. I'm going to take one last question, Laura. I'm going to throw it to you, and then we need to wrap up. And that is, you mentioned the man who had pulled away from the college. He was no longer, he was a little, I don't know what the right word is, but he wasn't happy anymore, and that the he was brought back to give, in essence, what ended up being the largest gift the college had received. Are there any tips, or what did the college do to cultivate him, to turn him around? Are there any hints that you can give our listeners for what they might do in the future to really bring back donors who have wandered away?
Well, in this instance, and in many instances, it's because the donor feels as if they're thanked when they give their donation, and then the organization, they hear nothing from the organization until the organization wants more money. So that's the true mistake that many, many organizations do. They don't do stewardship of their donors. So what this director of development did was actually, the donor lived in another city. So he made sure that he went to visit him in that city and set up a formal meeting and said, you know, we miss our relationship. I apologize for, you know, anything that someone may have done in the past, but we would really appreciate your input on what's going on at the college right now. So they actively solicited his input into what was going on at the college. And the fact that he was an alum, he had an interest in it. He just didn't feel like he was appreciated. So over the course of about 3 years, between visits in Winnipeg and in the other city, they became friends. They developed a friendship, and the college benefited from his advice. I mean, he was a businessman all his life, and so he had lots of things to say that could benefit the college. And so it was really a matter of just bringing him back into the fold, making sure that he had access to the president, that he was invited to special things, and that he had input on what was going on in the upcoming campaign. So that's really the secret, is just keep maintaining that relationship at a very high level.
Thank you for joining us for this session. If you would like more information, contact Karen Eber-Davis, Laura McCuska, Linda Popke, or Terry Temkin by typing in their name on Google with the word consultant.